Welcome back to the Existential Echo Chamber podcast. I really want to thank all of you guys for your feedback, for people who have been reaching out and saying that they're enjoying listening to the podcast. I know for those of you who are members of my blog, the Existential Echo Chamber, I originally created this with the intention of transferring these blog posts to an auditory format so you could listen to them on the go. Thank you for sticking with me on that. For those of you who are new, basically this podcast is my personal journey to discover the things that are true and to figure out, you know, what life is all about. And it's going to be basically conversations. We're going to talk about movies and books and video games and pop culture, lots of fun stuff. But we're also going to talk about politics and philosophy and religion, the history of early Christianity, and my own personal experiences leaving my faith and transitioning to a different philosophical point of view. So I hope that you're into looking at all aspects of life through the lens of those really great conversations where we try to piece together the things that we have in common and find, you know, the truth about what makes us human and, you know, really the story of being humans and how we should, you know, live our lives. That's sort of the big picture philosophical underpinning of the podcast, but we're definitely going to be doing movie reviews and I'm going to be having interviews with people from all different backgrounds about all different topics. We're going to talk about Star Wars. We're going to talk about, you know, politics, all sorts of stuff. So stick around and I hope that you enjoy the content so far. So, actually, this blog post that I'm going to read for this particular podcast was actually somewhat of a film analysis. I said in the last podcast that I, on the blog, have been taking a little bit of a break from heavy historical, posts, so that I could talk about some more introspective things, some more lighthearted things also. To keep people from getting too bogged down in historical minutiae and those sorts of things. So today's post I'm going to read from Friday, April 24th of 2020 is a film analysis of The Case for Christ, the 2017 film adaptation of Lee Strobel's popular apologetic book, The Case for Christ. Film analysis: The Decidedly Weak Case for Christ. So I have been reviewing, analyzing, debating, and mocking cheesy Christian movies for over 6 years now. It may come as a bit of a surprise for some readers to learn that when I started doing that, this enterprise, I was actually still a committed evangelical. I still went to church, I prayed every day, and I shared the story of Jesus with as many people as possible. However, as a movie buff and an aspiring screenwriter and a graduate of film school with a literal degree in this stuff, I also had a major problem with most faith-based movies. My reasons were simple enough and probably obvious to a lot of people. Here are my 7 main gripes. In general, these films tend to feature poorly written scripts that lack proper storytelling structure, bad acting, low or non-existent production value, sketchy and overbearing representations of Christian theology, problematic characterizations of not only atheists and people of other faiths, but of men, women, and even Christians, the alleged heroes of this genre of film. Misleading apologetic arguments. For those of you who may not know, apologetics simply means arguments defending the truth of Christianity. And these films also tend to have disingenuous presentations or exaggerations of a perceived Christian persecution. On top of these issues that almost always seem to plague Christian cinema, there's this nagging problem of commercialization and the question of who exactly these films are created for. As I have argued many times in the past, these films are not useful evangelistic tools. I believe this is primarily because they aren't trying to be. These movies, rather, are designed as little more than church fundraisers. They are, with very few exceptions, fundamentalist echo chambers writ large on the silver screen. Buses carrying youth groups, Sunday school classes, and seminary students drop off eager Christians who are obsessed with seeing their own relatively narrow, specific worldview affirmed for them at the movies for a change. Look, if you're not from the Bible Belt, I might understand why you would feel representation of your faith is significant and subsequently why you would enjoy watching these films. But for those of us born and bred in the South, the movies are little more than cynical products masquerading as evangelistic outreach. The people who make these movies want one thing: your money. They want you to sit there and laugh, cry, and nod your head and shout hallelujah as everything you already believe prior to walking into the theater is championed as completely true, good, and valid. They want you to high-five on the way out of the theater, go to Chick-fil-A, and discuss it with your small groups. And they want you to tell all of your friends how wonderful it is. And this works because of confirmation bias. You see what you want to see when you watch these movies. The looking glass stares back at you. Such contrived, cynical travesties of cinema genuinely turn my stomach. They are also a far cry from anything Jesus of Nazareth would have found amusing, useful, or relevant to seeking the kingdom of God. But that's enough about my disdain for these movies. For now, I wanted to offer a quick analysis of the film version of The Case for Christ, based on Lee Strobel's infamous apologetic book of the same name. I will accomplish this by weighing the film against the seven main issues I always raise with these movies that I just outlined, and evaluating the movie based on how much or how little it is guilty of these cardinal movie sins. I will then conclude this post by offering brief rebuttals of some of the particularly egregious apologetic arguments presented in the film. For those who are unfamiliar with either the film or the source material, for the sake of context, here is a brief sketch of the story. The film is a fictionalized account of the supposedly true events that led former investigative journalist Lee Strobel to faith in Christ. Strobel markets his story as one of a staunch atheist converting to Christ after investigating the claims for the historicity of the resurrection and the reliability of the gospel records and being overwhelmingly convinced by the evidence for the truth of the Bible's claims about Christ. In the film, his inquiry is prompted by his wife's conversion to Christianity and Lee's desire to prove she is wrong and restore order to his marriage. The film itself is a slow, ponderous series of interviews Lee conducts with various biblical scholars, doctors, and theologians about the veracity of the New Testament claims about Jesus. After a few hours of screen time, which is a few months in the story, Lee is convinced that he was wrong, apologizes to his wife, and accepts Jesus as his Lord and Savior. As a film, it's exceedingly generic, boring, and oddly paced. As a representation of the book it's based on, it's mostly okay. As a convincing defense of the gospel's claims about Jesus, I'm afraid the titular Case for Christ has still yet to be successfully made. So how does it stack up against my seven cardinal movie sins? Number one, poorly written script. Well, it's pretty bad. Chunky, clunky dialogue, odd pacing, and irrelevant forced subplots all work against it in this regard. Number two, bad acting. There are a few decent actors in this film. Mike Vogel and L. Scott Caldwell must have needed paychecks, and they do the best they can with the shoddy dialogue and paper-thin story they're telling, but almost everybody else in the film is objectively bad. Number three, low or non-existent production value. Now, I will give the film slight credit here. It's not shot terribly. There are sometimes interesting visual elements of the movie, and it doesn't come across as being shot on the grounds of some megachurch in South Georgia like some of these films do. Number four, sketchy and overbearing representations of Christian theology. The movie is somewhat guilty of this, but not as bad as some of its counterparts. For the most part, I didn't catch too many references to silly dogmatic fundamentalism from the lips of a Christian character. Number 5. Problematic characterizations of atheists, people of other faiths, and even Christians. Again, for the most part, this film avoids that. However, it does make one fatal mistake. It presents a supporting character as being an atheist who, as far as I can tell, is not really much of an atheist. In fact, later in this post, I will be challenging Lee Strobel's own assertion that he was an atheist. I'm not fully convinced of that after hearing his whole story. Number 6. Misleading apologetic arguments. That is basically all the movie is based on. It's tired, cliché, long ago debunked apologetic propaganda. I will be offering rebuttals to a few select arguments from the story presents as part of the overwhelming evidence that led to Strobel's conversion. Number 7. Disingenuous presentation or exaggeration of Christian persecution. Fortunately, this film avoids the bizarre fundamentalist Christian persecution complex that gave rise to the truly, madly, deeply awful God's Not Dead trilogy. There are no unrealistic scenes of American evangelical Christians being arrested, killed, or socially ostracized for professing a faith that overwhelmingly everyone else around them already believes in also. That was a major sigh of relief. Much like there is no war on Christmas, there is no organized war on Christianity. At least, not in the first world. The plots of all three God's Not Dead films read like early 2000s evangelical chain email nightmares. Even a lazy Google search will demonstrate how divorced from reality these celluloid echo chambers are. So on the whole, the movie is pretty bad, but it's not, like, absolutely abysmal. It's just mostly bleh, which is somehow worse. Now for the fun stuff. The movie makes some absolutely absurd claims that are allegedly the juggernaut arguments that swayed Strobel's mind and convinced him that Jesus is the Son of God. Here I will offer my favorite ones and explain why they are not, in fact, good arguments for faith in the divinity or resurrection of Jesus. Number 1. The Gospels are eyewitness accounts of the life of Jesus, written by people who knew him and his earliest followers. False. Jesus of Nazareth was born sometime around 4 BCE and died around the year 30 CE. The Gospels, in their original forms, were written anonymously 40 to 70 years later in other countries by Greek-speaking Christians who never met Jesus or any of his followers. The titles Gospel of Mark, of Matthew, of Luke, of John do not appear in manuscripts before the late 2nd or early 3rd century. The earliest Gospel, Mark, was written sometime around the end of the first Jewish revolt against Rome, which occurred between 66 and 73 CE, with most scholars agreeing it was probably composed around the year 70. Matthew was written probably 10 to 15 years later in 80 to 85 CE. Luke and John, sometime later still, probably near the close of the first century, between 90 and 100 AD. Our earliest surviving and best copies of the Gospels mostly date from the 3rd, 4th, and 5th centuries or later. The film references the earliest surviving manuscript, which is a tiny, credit card-sized piece of the 4th Gospel, containing John 18:36 through 19:7, which has been paleographically dated to sometime in the 2nd century, possibly in the early half of the century, within a few decades of the original composition of John. Regardless, John was written nearly 70 years after Jesus died, and not by an apostle. Without going into great detail, I will offer you one rather obvious reason why the Gospels could not possibly have been written by eyewitnesses. Jesus and his followers were poor Aramaic-speaking day laborers from rural Galilee. They were not educated, and they were almost certainly illiterate, like 90% of Roman-occupied Judea. even if they had been capable of basic reading and writing, none of them would have been fluent in Koine Greek, the language of the New Testament manuscripts. It is also worth pointing out that every surviving Christian text or non-Christian reference to Jesus outside of the New Testament dates to the end of the first century or later. Tacitus, Josephus, Pliny the Younger, etc., were not contemporaries of Jesus or his disciples. So, sorry, Lee, this evidence can safely be thrown out in any legitimate investigation into early Christian origins. Number two, textual criticism demonstrates the historical accuracy of the Gospels. Now, this claim, as far as I can tell, is simply a bald-faced lie. Textual criticism refers to the work undertaken by academically motivated historians of early Christianity who performed the complex task of applying rigorous historical criteria to the earliest surviving Greek manuscripts in order to try to peel back the layers of tradition as much as possible, separate obvious later invention from historically plausible, or in some cases probable, events, and present the world with a better understanding of what the historical Jesus might have been like and what his earliest followers believed and taught. They are tasked with sifting through roughly 5,800 Greek manuscripts of the New Testament. If that sounds like a lot of manuscripts, well, it is. In fact, as Strobel likes to gloat, we have more surviving manuscripts from the New Testament than we do any other work of antiquity. There are a couple of problems with attempting to use this as evidence for the historicity of the divinity of Jesus or the historical reliability of the gospel narratives. First, we don't have the original copies of any of the books of the New Testament. What we have are bits and pieces of copies 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 of, you get the point. The earliest fragment, as discussed above, dates sometime around the middle of the 2nd century, more than 100 years after the death of Jesus and decades after the original was written. Even if we could know for certain what the original text of the earliest gospel said, we would still be 40 years removed from the events it describes, and even if the accounts were literally eyewitness reports, that still wouldn't prove the historical accuracy of the events the gospel records. Second, it is pretty disingenuous for apologists to claim we have 5,800 copies of the Greek manuscripts of the New Testament and leave out the fact that basically any scrap of any copy of New Testament gospel or letter is considered a, quote, copy of the manuscript. Many of our copies are just fragmentary pieces of books. Worse still, while it is true that we have lots of copies, it's also true that they all differ from one another in hundreds of thousands of ways. Most differences are small, a misspelled word here, a skipped line there, a repeated phrase, etc. Some, however, are quite significant. For example, in Mark 1:41, when the man reaches out to touch Jesus, was Christ pissed off or was he, quote, moved with pity? Well, that depends on which manuscript you read. Look up this verse in both the New International Version and any of the other popular versions like the New King James, the English Standard, or the New American Standard. So, which is it? Did Jesus get mad or did he feel sorry for the guy? What do you think the original most likely said? If you were a scribe, which of these options feels most probable to have been a change to line up with accepted Orthodox beliefs? Would any Christian scribe have possibly read, Jesus was moved with pity, and changed it to, Jesus was moved with indignation? Or is it possible that the earlier copies, in fact, said that Jesus was angry, and some scribe changed it because such a notion didn't fit the later theological narrative of the church? I'm merely posing the question. There are many, many examples of strange discrepancies like this in our surviving manuscripts, and there are many other types of mistakes or discrepancies too, and they make it very difficult to determine what earlier copies of the books looked like. No serious scholar will tell you, as some of the characters in this movie try to suggest, that we, quote, expect to find differences in the manuscripts because it makes them more trustworthy. No, it doesn't. It just makes them more likely to be historically unreliable and written by flawed human hands. hands that have agendas, beliefs, and biases just like everyone else. And for the record, it's not surprising we have so many more copies of the New Testament than we do other ancient writings. Christianity was the predominant religion of the biggest empire in the world for centuries. There were more people with more time, resources, and motivation to copy these texts in more places than any other literature in history. And when these texts were lost to time and circumstance, there were more people in more places with more resources actively looking for these lost documents than there have ever been searching for almost anything else of value from antiquity. It's not miraculous, it's expected. So, once again, I'm sorry, Lee. None of this is very good evidence for the reliability of the claims about Christ, either. Fun fact, we have approximately 5,800 Greek copies, and from later centuries we have 10,000 Latin copies and 9,300 copies in other languages such as Coptic, Syriac, Ethiopic, Armenian, among a handful of others. Number 3. The empty tomb provides physical evidence for the resurrection. No, it does not. Supposing there was an empty tomb, all it would prove is that Jesus' body isn't in that tomb. The empty tomb narrative, as I have pointed out at some length in my Resurrecting Jesus post, is probably best explained as a later tradition proposed as a form of apologetic line against the Jewish skeptics who scoffed at the idea of the resurrection. Our earliest confirmed empty tomb story comes from Mark's Gospel, written some 40 years after the alleged resurrection of Jesus, and the bottom line is that the story cannot be verified. The apologists in the film make bizarre claims that we know the stories aren't made up because all of the Gospels include the empty tomb and say women found the empty tomb. The logic appears to be that if all four Gospels say it, it must be true, and that since everybody knows ancient people hated women, the authors of the Gospel accounts would not have made that up because it would have made women, whom they obviously hate, look good. I hate to keep having to apologize to Lee, but this logic is hardly compelling. Sure, all four Gospels have an empty tomb story. They all four differ in lots of ways also. Which women went to the tomb? What did they find when they got there? When and where did Jesus appear? To whom? What did he say? All of these questions will be answered differently depending on which gospel you read. Check it out for yourself. Don't take my word for it. I'm not so certain that multiple attestation alone can be counted on to tell us that something is reliable historically. After all, millions of Americans post demonstrably false but incredibly similar recollections of current events on social media all the time. Also, there is virtually no evidence to suggest that the earliest followers of Jesus hated women. In fact, there is plenty of evidence to the contrary. The idea that women being identified as having found the empty tomb makes the story more probable to have occurred is a stretch. Perhaps it simply reflects a tradition that Mary was the first eyewitness to the resurrection. We don't know for sure. As such, none of this is particularly compelling evidence that Jesus came back from the dead. Sorry. Number 4. The disciples probably weren't lying about the resurrection because they all got martyred for their faith. And nobody dies for a lie. Except for when they do, which is more than 0 times in human history. More pressingly, as I tried to demonstrate at some length in my Resurrecting Jesus post, most scholars don't think the disciples were lying. The simplest explanation for a belief in the resurrection of Jesus is that one or more of his earliest followers believed they saw him alive for one reason or another shortly after his death and convinced others of what they saw. Grief-stricken dreams, visions, or hallucinations occasioned by extreme cognitive dissonance accounts for the earliest stories of the resurrection. Apologists often try to make a huge deal out of the story of Jesus appearing to 500 people at once after his death. The reason that there is no way it could have been mass hallucination. They reason that there's no way it could have been mass hallucinations. Well, I agree. I just have a far simpler explanation than a supernatural resurrection. It didn't happen. As far as Jesus appearing to 500 witnesses at one time, that is a story we first learn from Paul in 1 Corinthians, which was written around 53 or 54 CE, nearly 25 years after the alleged events. Now, while it is true, as the movie gleefully points out, that Paul claims this tradition was passed on to him by other Christians, he makes no comment about who these people were, where they lived, or if they knew any of these supposed 500 witnesses. I am at a loss as to how this could be convincing evidence of the resurrection. It would be like me saying some guy down at the Quick Trip told me that in 1994, Kurt Cobain appeared alive after his death to 500 people in and around the suburbs of Seattle. You'd probably not be impressed by that anonymous source or his tale. Yeah, I wouldn't either. To address the last part of this argument, that the, quote, the disciples all died for their faith, I will simply offer a simple fact. Nobody knows much of anything for sure about what happened to the disciples after Jesus died. We have some evidence that a few of the earliest Christian apostles were executed on the cusp of or during the first Jewish revolt against Rome, sometime between 66 and 73 AD. Tradition, not verifiable fact, indicates that Peter probably died by crucifixion in Rome around 64 to 68 CE, possibly earlier. James, the brother of Jesus and leader of the church at Jerusalem, probably died around the year 69 during the height of the revolt. Paul probably died shortly before all of them, maybe around the year 62. Neither James or Paul were members of the original 12 disciples, and all three men were likely charged with sedition and treason, just like Jesus, and for not dissimilar reasons. As it turns out, proclaiming that Jesus, a crucified rebel, is the king of the Jews and that he is returning soon to destroy Rome and set up God's kingdom on earth is just as unpopular on the cusp of a violent revolution 35 years after said rebel's state-ordered execution as his original apocalyptic rants about the Son of Man were in the late 20s of the Common Era. It is true that we have legends about the other disciples that come from later generations and later centuries after the original followers of Jesus had passed from the scene. It is also true that in many of these stories, the disciples die martyrs' deaths. Most scholars do not believe these are particularly reliable accounts. The simple fact is, for almost all of the disciples, we simply do not and cannot know when, where, or how they died. While it's not impossible they died martyrs for their faith in Jesus, I think it's far more historically plausible that if they died at the hands of Rome, it occurred during the Jewish revolt when Jerusalem was sacked, the temple got destroyed, and more than 1 million Jews were slaughtered, according to Josephus. Early Christian martyrs were actually few and far between, and the ones that did die were viewed as Jewish traitors to Rome and were executed for political reasons, just like Jesus. Religious persecution of Christians came about somewhat later and intensified in the period during and after the Jewish war with Rome. It's possible the disciples of Jesus were among them, but we simply don't know that for sure. So again, sorry, Lee. I'd like to wrap this post up by pointing out that Lee Strobel himself admits that he was mostly just irreligious and not concerned with religion. He was not an atheist in the sense that he actively spoke out against God and was some sort of activist against religion. He also points out that when he undertook his investigation in 1981, that he did it mostly by reading apologetics. None of the interviews he conducted for his book that are dramatized in the film actually occurred until the mid-90s, some 17 years after he became a Christian. The Case for Christ was published over a decade after Lee became a pastor. So I'm also curious as to why he chooses to characterize his story as a skeptic tracking down hard evidence for Jesus and at the last being forced to face the truth. Sounds a bit disingenuous to me. Perhaps like a marketing ploy to sell more books? Just food for thought. Look, I'm not mad at Lee Strobel. Apologetics fills a need in the evangelical community, and he provides that service. Apologetic arguments aren't designed to convince or convert atheists. They're meant to comfort doubting Christians who need a little reassurance from time to time that they are still on the winning team when life gets tough and faith is hard to come by. They are merely another extension of the echo chamber, another reflection from the looking glass of our own biases, expectations, hopes, fears, and beliefs. I sympathize. I understand needing to believe in something so strongly that you will engage in all sorts of complicated mental gymnastics to make it line up with history, science, and common sense. I just think it's sad that so many people feel a need to double down on ideas they suspect to be faulty simply because they were afraid of exploring the possibility that they might be wrong.